2 weeks ago, we saw the failure of the priesthood, the wickedness of Eli's sons, ultimately the capture of the Ark of the Covenant. And then we had the demand of the Israelites for a king. And so we ended 1 Samuel chapter 12 with the coronation of King Saul. Now, was this a good thing or a bad thing? Okay. Why was it a bad thing? So we have that there, the coronation of Saul is bad because Israel has rejected God as their king. And so God is, as Dennis said, is giving them what they want in punishment and in judgment. And yet there's also is a sense where this is a good thing. So the correct answer would have been yes. So in what way is this a good thing? It is setting up the kingship so that ultimately we go from Saul to David, who is the ancestor of the Messiah, who through the kingship of David, we see great promises given to Israel and the fulfillment, the ultimate fulfillment of those great promises. So what do you remember about Saul himself? We touched on this, I think, last week. What kind of man was he? Yeah, he was really tall. He was humble. We see there a very definite littleness in his own eyes. And we actually have relatively little about King Saul himself. We only have a few chapters that are only about King Saul. Very quickly, we're going to be seeing King Saul in his interactions with David. But chapter 13 of 1 Samuel, it says the very first verse, Saul reigned 1 year, and when he reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash and in the mountains of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. The rest of the people he sent away, every man to his tent. And so what we have is Paul now establishes a standing army, and that's always on duty for Israel. What we see happen, I'm going to skim much of this, the next section here. Jonathan goes and attacks the garrison of the Philistines, the fortress of the Philistines nearby, and there begin to be a battle. And verse 6, when the men of Israel saw that they were in danger, for the people were distressed, then the people hid in caves and thickets and rocks and holes and in pits. And some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. So from those two verses, how would you describe the army and the warriors of Israel at that point? They were terrified. They were afraid. And so they run, they hide, they go out of the area where the Philistines are to cross the Jordan River to put as much territory and an entire river between them and the Philistines. There in the middle of verse 7, as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. So there is incredible fear right now. And you have to remember, yeah, we're talking about the Philistines. We have a broader history of Israel and the Philistines than the Israelites knew at that time. You know, we remember the story of David and Goliath. We know the victories that are to come. But up to this point in time, the Philistines have been the primary oppressor of Israel for several generations. So that you have, of course, Samson fighting, fighting the Philistines. You have, of course, it was the Philistines who defeated the Israelites, took the Ark of the Covenant. So these are their major enemy. They had kept Israel under bondage for a long time. And now as they've gone into battle, they're definitely not winning. And they're terrified. They're not seeing any real success here. And so Saul was in a town called Gilgal, and everyone seemed to go to him there, and they are terrified. They're looking to him as their king and for probably direction, for strength. And verse 8, it says, then he waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So apparently Samuel had told Saul, I will meet you here, I'll be there in about a week. And all the people have come to Gilgal, they're terrified, and Saul is waiting. And Samuel doesn't show up. And the people now, the end of verse 8, what are the people doing? Scattering. They're scattered from him. They've come to Gilgal hoping for guidance. They've sat around for 7 days and nothing's happening. And so now the people are leaving. They're running, find other places to hide. They're going back home. They're going to probably cross the river some more. They're all leaving. And Saul is, if you can picture King Saul there, and this is apparently the first really major campaign of battle, and it is going terribly, and instead of solidifying his reign, instead of establishing him as the ruler of Israel and you know, bringing the armies around him in triumph, the people are terrified, and Saul is just seemingly doing nothing. And you can imagine, you've probably been in situations where you know things are not going, not right. Things are a mess right here, whether it be in the company or some other situation. You work for somebody and the company's in shambles, and you think, well, why isn't the leadership doing anything? And we're still waiting, and they're not doing anything. We're still waiting, they're not doing anything. And that's what's going on here. And so Saul said, verse 9, bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me. And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened, as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering, that Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him that he might greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? Saul said, when I saw that the people were scattered from me and that you did not come within the days appointed and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering. Now, what's the problem with Saul offering a burnt offering? He was not a priest. Saul has no authority to make sacrifice. This was a clear division in Israel that actually remained, that the priesthood and the kingship were never joined together. They were two separate institutions. And Saul has no authority to make a burnt offering. And in the context, I think it's apparent, it's not just that Saul took his burnt offering to a priest and had the priest make it, but rather Saul himself goes and acts as if he is a priest to make offerings. Now, why does he do it? So he says, I felt compelled. Why did Saul feel compelled to make a burnt offering? Now, I'll give you a hint. The answer is not worship. Yeah, he's scared. I think Jim said it very well. I'm thinking, I got to do something. And so what does he do? He does something that appears pious. But I would argue that there is more of an intent or concern for the, we would call it the political ramifications of what he did, than the actual significance of worship to God, of seeking God's blessing. By offering sacrifice, he gives the appearance of we're seeking God's blessing so that now we can go into battle, because he sees the Philistines nearby. They are gathered up. They are very apparently readying themselves for battle, readying themselves to attack his camp, which is fracturing. And people are scattering. So every day he waits, his army gets smaller. And he has to bring everybody together. He has to have have an army that's ready to go into battle. So what does he do? He offers sacrifice. He has no right to do that. And so he arrogates to himself. He very proudly takes to himself something that God gave him no authority to do. And so he says, Samuel says in verse 13, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. I know we didn't go back there. I'm trusting that you remember the Old Testament law well enough to know that, you know, the Levites were the only ones given the authority to make the sacrifices. And it was very clearly spelled out in the law. Nobody else could do that but Levites. And so he had not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after God's own heart. And the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. And so one of the things that we're seeing, and remembering this big overarching theme of 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, is the failure of the kingship. The inability of the kingship to secure the people in the Mosaic covenant. That instead of these kings being the ones who are going to bring them into triumph and establishing them in an unending security in the land, we see over and over and over again the kings fail. The kings fall into the same wickedness that the people of Israel were practicing. And we see very quickly, how long into Saul's reign is this? Second year of his reign. And he is already beginning to act in, I would say at the very least, self-interest. And what we see in this is the kings are not going to secure and establish Israel. And that's the overarching theme. And I don't want us to lose sight of that. But there's also in these chapters too, there are principles we can learn, if you will, that are more, I'll say more directly applicable to daily life. But there are principles of how we think about our relationship with God. Here, Romans 15 tells us things that were written aforetime were written for our learning, for our profit. So there's things we can profit from here. And as we think about obedience to God, because that's what this really comes down to, is obedience. Saul knows. Well, I think we can safely assume Saul knows he has no right to make sacrifice. I mean, it's not that there's any question here. Wonder if I can do this. Yeah, I think I can do it. He knows better. But what he determines is, well, there's something in this situation, there's something better than obedience. And so that what we see here, obedience to God is essential, especially when disobedience appears better. When it appears more spiritual, when it appears like it's going to gain me greater advantage, because Saul was legitimately risking his kingdom by waiting. There's no, at least to all human appearances. Things were incredibly tenuous at that point. There was no certainty at all that Samuel was going to come, that they were going to be ready to go into battle, that the people were going to be able to stand. Everything just hung by a thread. And so it seemed as if disobedience was the better option. Except it wasn't at all. And obedience is always a sin. It is always the better option. I want to take a minute, and I'm kind of jumping out of this text, but I want to launch into a couple things just for our thinking about it this morning. Because what we have, again, if you can put yourself there in Saul's shoes on that seventh day, when everything's in turmoil, everything's uncertain, defeat is the only thing that seems likely to happen. And now there is this incredible pressure. He says, I felt compelled. There is this pushing to do this. There's all of these pressures, both external and internal, that says, go do this. What do we call that when we have these pressures to go do sinful things? Temptation. Yeah, we're tempted. And one of the things that Saul fails to see, and one of the ways some temptation succeeds so well is it tells us lots and lots and lots of lies. In Saul's case, what were some of the lies that his temptation was probably telling him? I'm going to have you let you speculate a little bit. What are some of the lies that his temptation to offer burnt offerings were probably telling him? Yeah, sacrifice is a good thing. You're worshiping God. It's okay. What else? Yeah, Samuel's not coming. So there's no hope in the appointed prophet and priest of God. There's no hope in the man of God. Okay, you're about to be defeated. You are going to lose if you don't do this. What are maybe some other lies? Not only is he going to lose a battle, he's the lie of temptation saying you're going to lose your position, you're going to lose your kingship. God appointed you king. You should do everything you can to secure that which God gave you. So go ahead and do this. And the lies of temptation, ultimately they come down to God is... We see this in several ways in scriptures. One of the very first lie of temptation is God is keeping something good from you. The very first lie of temptation was, if you eat this fruit, you'll be like God. God has said don't eat this because he doesn't want you to be like him. The lie of Saul's temptation is, basically, if you obey, if you wait, you're going to lose your kingship. You're going to lose the battle. You're going to lose all these good things that you have right now. God's keeping that back from you. God's keeping victory from you by having this rule there. Another lie of temptation is God will not protect you. You got to do something. I know it's not right, but you got to do something. Otherwise, you're going to die. You're all going to be defeated. And again, I can hear the temptation saying, but think about all the people that are there. It's not just you, Saul. You've got all these thousands of people. They're going to die and go into slavery too if you don't do this. And the lie is that we have to do something contrary to the will of God, because if we don't, God is going to fail to keep his promises and protect us. Another lie of temptation is that God is not enough. Really, some of this gets down to, could Saul have been content to chase his father's donkeys, as he did in chapters 10 and 11? Could he have been content to walk in righteousness as a lowly backwoods herdsman after he had become the king of Israel? Is God enough for him in anonymity, in incredible loss, when everything that he has suddenly been given? Remember, he didn't earn any of this. He didn't do anything for this. It was given to him wholesale by God himself. And yet Saul now feels like, I need to keep it. I need to work at this and keep it for myself. And that part of this is that God and God's provision wasn't enough for him. He needed something more. Part of it too is sin is better than God. And because ultimately that's what we're talking about when we're talking about sin, is that which separates us from a close relationship with God. And so that the lie of sin, it's not so apparent here in this chapter, but we see it elsewhere in scriptures, is that, well, this sin is actually better than God. It's more pleasurable than God, or it's going to provide or protect or secure or satisfy in some way. And what it does is it says this thing is more desirable than God himself. We also see that you can do better and you know better than God. And that's really evident here. Saul knew the command of God. God had said only the Levites. The prophet of God had said, wait for me. And Saul said, yeah, I tried that. It didn't work. And that is one of the most disheartening but also frequently stated complaint, if you will, about God. I tried that. It didn't work. I went to church. I went down front. I prayed the prayer. I got baptized and it didn't work. I tried applying that principle and my spouse never changed. They acted like they always did. It didn't work. And if I had been designing this whole thing, I would have done it this way. We don't ever probably think that clearly, but that's what's going on in the back of our minds. is I know better and I could do better with this situation than God's doing. Which we know. I mean, we think about it. I stated it in the cold facts like that. And we know, well, that's foolish. God is infinitely wise and I am very definitely not. And yet, when it comes to temptation, sin comes along and whispers, well, God's not handling this right. You need to step in and take care of this way. And that's exactly what Saul tried. And as a result, what did he lose? I'd say a dynasty. But yeah, he lost his throne. The kingdom was taken from him and his family. So let me move on. Chapter 14. We see that there is a battle. And actually the Israelites do not even have a sword or spear except for what Saul and Jonathan had. That's it. So they're going into this with no real weapons of warfare. There's slings and rocks and trees and clubs and whatever they can find. But they don't have any metal weaponry, which is kind of necessary when you're fighting an army with armor and chariots and lots of swords. So they go into battle. And Jonathan, chapter 14, Jonathan actually, he and his armor bearer go and they begin to fight a band of Philistines and win a great victory. And verse 15 of chapter 14, the Israelites, the camp of the Israelites hear the battle going on. They hear the noise of the battle between Jonathan, his armor bearer, and the Philistines. And it says there was trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and the raiders also trembled in the earthquake, so there was a very great trembling. Now, so we have, I think, two tremblings going on. You actually have this trembling of the ground, the shaking of the ground because of, I would suggest maybe some divine intervention here, but you also have the trembling of the people. They are quaking in fear still. Verse 16, now the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away. So they're not just scattered now. They're melting. They're slinking away. You know, they're looking for the nearest bush. The guy's hiding behind his buddy looking for an out. You know, they're melting away in fear. And verse 17, Saul calls for roll, and he looks to see who's missing. He knows people are now going AWOL and he wants to know who's missing. And they discover that Jonathan and his armor bearer are missing. Verse 20, tells us there's great confusion, in the camp of the Philistines. Moreover, verse 21, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. So battle's been engaged. And we find that there were a lot of Israelites in the Philistines' army. I would guess they had been conscripted. They were there against their will because they were still an oppressed people. A lot of the Israelite towns were under the control of the Philistines. And so when they get into battle, the Israelites in the Philistine army turn against their captors, which you would kind of expect, I would think, but they turn against their captors so that now you have this mass confusion on the battlefield as the Philistines find themselves not just facing an enemy in front of them, but facing enemies in their midst as well. But verse 24, it says, and the men of Israel were distressed that day. So they are trembling, melting away, and now they are distressed because Saul had made an oath. He said, if anyone touches any food today, you're all cursed. You're going to be punished. If you eat anything until evening before I have finished this victory, you're all under my wrath. So none of them ate anything during the day. Now, Jim, how important is it for a soldier to get food out in the field? Jim was telling me a couple weeks ago, I think it was, the Army spends millions of dollars on food for guys out in the field. And we recognize, you know, having food, something good to eat, even in the midst of battle, having a place to stop and to refresh yourself for a minute is vitally important. And especially when we're talking hand-to-hand combat here. as well. So we're talking an intense, vigorous battle. Can you imagine wrestling or boxing for an entire day with nothing to eat? That's the kind of situation Saul has put them in. And what chapter 14 is showing us actually is the foolishness of Saul, the rashness of it. Verse 29, Jonathan didn't hear this oath. He's going through a wood and sees this honey, and he's hungry, so he picks up the honey and begins to eat the honey out of the honeycomb. And somebody tells him, your father swore that he was going to punish anybody who ate anything. And what Jonathan says, verse 29, my father has troubled the land. Look now how my countenance is brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much better if the people had eaten freely today the spoil of their enemies which they found. For now would there not have been a much greater slaughter among the Philistines. So Jonathan says, this is not a good thing my dad did. We could have been even more victorious if he had some food. And so it's found out that someone ate food. Verse 39, King Saul says, as the Lord lives, who saves Israel, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. But not a man among all the people answered him. So all of Israel, they know Jonathan's eaten, all the soldiers here. They don't say anything. And so they begin to go through the process of casting lots to find out who it is. And it determines that they discover that it's Jonathan's the one who ate a little bit of food. Verse 44, Saul answered and said, God do so and more also, for you shall surely die. So Saul's foolishness has now put him in this point of condemning his own son to death. And yet the people, verse 45, the people said to Saul, shall Jonathan die who has accomplished this great deliverance in Israel? Certainly not. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So by Saul's actions, he has shown himself to be a poor general, a poor leader, so that now he has the soldiers in opposition to him. And delivering his son from a foolish statement in the first place, and then Saul was willing to make it even worse by following through with it. So, I mean, Saul is putting himself in a situation where he can't win. He's either going to break his word or he's going to kill his son. And the people intervene and essentially, at least in this moment, rebel against Saul. And he shows his folly as a ruler. And I think part of what we see is the arrogance that is still present, that he has thought nothing about the people. He's thought nothing about their needs as soldiers, their concerns in battle. What he has said is, cursed is anyone who eats anything until I have my vengeance. He's entirely self-centered. And obviously the consequences are not as bad as they could have been, but the consequences are definitely bad. And then chapter 15. We have Saul going to the Amalekites. Verse 3, Samuel commands Saul, gives him the command from God, now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and do not spare them, but kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. Now this is probably a more familiar portion of Saul's story. Saul's history here, but how much of the Amalekites and their possessions is Saul to destroy? Okay, what's he to leave behind? Nothing. Absolutely wipe out without exception everything. That's important. I know some of you already know the importance of it. That's important for the rest of this. So Saul, verse 4, gathered together the people, numbered them in Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men of Judah. And Saul came to a city of Amalek and lay in wait. And I'm going to read all of this. They go and they fight against, with the help of the Kenites. They let a group known as the Kenites leave, and then they fight against the Amalekites. And verse 8, it says, he also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them, but everything despised and worthless that they utterly destroyed. So what kind of things did they keep? How does it describe the things they kept? Yeah, the best of them, the things that are really good. The things they destroyed, how does it describe them? Yeah, useless, worthless. Did you say subpar? Yeah, that's a good word for it. That useless stuff. Nobody wanted anyway. So they kept what they wanted and destroyed what they didn't want. And so now, verse 11, God speaks to Samuel and says, I greatly regret that I've set up Saul as my king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. And so Samuel now goes to Carmel where Saul is. And verse 13, Saul greets Samuel saying, blessed are you of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. So Saul says, I'm glad you're here. I did exactly what God says. What does Samuel say? Why do I hear sheep? Then verse 15, Saul said, they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed. So who does Saul blame for this? Yeah, the people. He said, they did. The people kept these things back. And he said, we destroyed all the rest. Why did they keep them? To make sacrifice. You'd think Saul would have learned his lesson already with this whole sacrifice thing, but he hasn't. They kept them to make sacrifice. And then Samuel says, be quiet. I will tell you what the Lord has said to me last night. And Samuel basically says, the kingdom is being taken away from you. Verse 19, he says, why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of God? Saul said to Samuel, but I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me and brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took of the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. Now, I think it's interesting. I'm not going to go any farther than to point it out, but I think it's interesting that in both these cases, Saul says to Samuel, the Lord your God. He doesn't say the Lord my God. But he here places the blame, again, on the people to say they did this to make sacrifice. And then these two verses, I trust, are familiar to you. If not, they're really informative verses that you are well worth you giving some serious study to. Verse 22, Samuel said, has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. And just as a side note, that's a crucial statement. If we're going to understand the rest of Israel's history, they're on failures in idolatry. There's a thing that's interesting in Israel's idolatry from this point, particularly from David onward, is they never utterly abandoned the worship of God. They continued to worship God. And there were times where the temple was shuttered by the king, and so that it fell to an incredibly low point. But we see Israel worshiping primarily God and gods. And so that the Isaiah and Jeremiah both suggest to us that they are thinking that all that matters is the performance of the outward rituals. If we make the sacrifices, keep these particular laws, then that's all that matters. As long as we do the outward rituals, it's all that matters, and we can go do all the rest of whatever we want to do, and it doesn't matter. And Scriptures clearly condemns that. If we are going to worship God, it has to be from that position of an obedient heart. All, yes, outward obedience, but also internal obedience. So their lips must be close to God, and our hearts must also be close to God. And Jeremiah says, and Jesus quotes this, with your lips you've drawn close to me, but with your heart you're far from me. And we must be in full obedience to God. Because it's obedience that matters most. Verse 23, rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. So again, we see in this portion of Saul's life that obedience is better, even when disobedience seems more spiritual. And I think that this whole, they took the things just to make sacrifice, was an excuse. I'm sure they were going to make sacrifice of some of them, but I'm also pretty confident that a lot of the really, really good herds were going to end up in somebody's backyard, not on the altar to God. But even if they had to sacrifice absolutely everything on the altar, it wouldn't matter, because the command was destroy it all. And because Saul has persisted in this rebellion and stubbornness, he has rejected the word of the Lord. That's what he's done. And it is helpful, and I think it's necessary for us at times as we think through our own lives and we think through sin, what it is, what it actually is. It's a rejection of the word of the Lord. It is saying, God, I know you have said this, but I don't believe it. I don't think that's the best way. I think something else. And God, I know you have said this, but I know I should do this instead. Or I know I can do this instead. I know you have said this is the best way to live, but I think I've got a better way. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about sin. All the way back in the Garden of Eden, still today, happening millions of times right now. People are saying, yeah, I think this is the better way to live. God has said, but this, whatever this is. And so that what we come down to is saying, I don't want to do, I don't want to believe what God has said. And Saul, it cost him his kingdom. It cost him, again, the dynasty. Saul's example, Saul's history here, it's very informative as we see the beginning of the failures of the kings, but it's also some crucial lessons is how we think through sin and temptation, how we think through our relationship with God. You know, God is not content with pious seeming half measures. He wants our obedience. He wants us to simply do what he said.